Welcome into the Towel Boys. He's Mike Grimala. I'm Tyler Bischoff. Mike, we're in April, and our top two most listened to shows have been the two since the season ended.
Hope springs eternal. You know, you get that season, you get that disappointing season out of the way. As soon as you, the buzzer sounds on that final game, you start thinking about next year. So I think that's what, you know, the fans are already sort of getting caught up in.
But that's still not supposed to be how it works. Like I know what you're saying. It was a bad year, and people are excited, and you know, there's reason to be excited. But it's like, you don't get good ratings when the season's over. You get good ratings when the team's actually playing. Like, people aren't supposed to keep caring at this point.
Or maybe you get good ratings when you put on a good show, and people
keep coming back and telling their friends. That's probably
it's got to be it.
That's it. Well, he's Mike Grimala. He's over at RunRevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. We're going to talk some Rashad Vaughn today. We're going to talk Nigel Williams-Goss as well, and then a little bit more general on the NCAA tournament. But starting with Rashad Vaughn, he's officially gone. Announced it with a video that he'll enter the NBA draft. And basically, Mike, what you had said the last two shows, the title of the video was Following My Dream to the NBA. And that's basically what you said, that was his goal. That was his dream all along, was one and done NBA. And that's what it was. I will say this. He denied those. There was the Adrian Wojnarowski report that he was going to hire an agent, and then there was something else, and I can't remember what it was. I think it was just a tweet about him, signing with an agency. And he denied both of those, and I think he only denied them because he wanted his video to break.
Do you want to hear my theory on this?
Yes.
He's wearing his UNLV polo or a hat in the video. Was he wearing a hat in the video? Anyway, my theory is that he committed to UNLV on live TV, and then as soon as the commitment show was over, he went into a different room, sat down in front of a camera, and recorded this going to the NBA announcement, and then they just added in some highlights as the season went along, and that way they had the video ready to roll at the end of the year. That's my theory. I think that was the plan all along.
Listen, that would be the most efficient thing UNLV did all season.
It wouldn't surprise me if this is how he had it lined up. Like, he denied that, you know, he denied the reports and everything because he wanted to make his announcement, I guess. And a pretty good announcement. I don't know if I can remember anyone else sort of doing it that way, you know, making a video and then sending it out as to make their official announcement. But
yeah, Sam Decker wrote a letter to, like, Wisconsin fans, and then Kentucky had their 7-man press conference where Calipari just asked him to stand up. It was certainly different. I know, like, UNLV didn't make the video. Like, it was Rashad Vaughn's people, whoever those are, that made the, like, it wasn't UNLV that made the video.
Yeah.
So it was all Rashad Vaughn or whoever is close to Rashad Vaughn that made that video. And it wasn't the greatest video ever, but it was good, and it was different. So I liked it.
Yeah. I think he had it ready to go since the start of the season. And then it just, after every game, they're just cutting in some highlights and throwing it in there. It's all very, you know, general. I'm following my dream. I'm, proud to play.
Well, they had some video in there of him, like, dancing in the locker room with teammates.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, like, the part that he narrated.
But why would you put that in there? Just to be like, I loved UNLV and see, look at how happy I was? Okay. Just to, I don't know, make UNLV fans feel better about something.
Yeah, it was a nice message, but it was very, like, nothing he said, like, during the video couldn't have been said, like, before the season.
Okay, what is he in the NBA? What's his, we're going to say he gets drafted in the second round, which, you know, there's a good chance he might not actually play in the NBA next year. Could be in the D League or something, but what is his NBA? And I'm not out. You can give me ceiling or floor or whatever. But what do you think he is in the NBA?
NBA. So the first thing is, I saw, you know, most people saying, you know, hey, congratulations, good luck. You know, it was good to have you for a year. Good luck in the NBA. Some people saying, you know, hey, you should have stayed another year. You got to improve that draft stock. You know, you don't want to be in the D League or whatever. I don't think he's in a terrible situation. He's going to get a chance to prove himself. Like, any team that drafts him is going to give him, you know, a chance to develop and sort of make the team. It's not like a Roscoe Smith or Ken Burch, who were, you know, last year where they you know, just trying to make a team in training camp. Rashad Vaughn, he'll, you know, teams will invest in him a little bit. So he'll have a chance to improve and eventually become a contributor. The ceiling, I'm not sure about a player comparison, but he's a guy that can score. He can make shots. If he can make open three-pointers, like, he'll eventually find a place. If he can play, you know, turn into a credible defender who can hit three-pointers, you know, easier said than done. I think he could have a place. But the one thing he's got going for him is size. You know, he's a legit 6'5", maybe even 6'6". So he's got, you know, NBA shooting guard size. He's not going to have to be a combo guard. He's not going to have to, you know, do any of that stuff. He can, you know, focus on that, you know, playing that position and being a scorer first. So I think there's definitely a possibility that he'll carve out a role and could eventually become, you know, an NBA player.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how similar is he to J.R. Smith?
Say, you know, maybe a 6 or a 7. He's got that same sort of size. He's got that same, you know, offense-first mentality. J.R. Smith, probably a little more athletic. He was a guy, he's a big dunker, like, early in his career. He's a guy that could, you know, when he got to the rim, he could go up and finish. Not so much anymore. He's pretty much just a three-point shooter now. Rashad Vaughn, maybe, like, a little bit better ball handler, a little more creative off the dribble, maybe. But I could see that comparison.
I'd have to think more, but that was the first one that popped into my mind when I'm making comparison. And I don't know that he would have as good of a career as J.R. Smith has.
I mean, but J.R. Smith is... I'm sure if you offered that to Rashad Vaughn right now, he'd probably sign up for it. Like, J.R. Smith, how many would probably, he's probably made $80 million in his career. I'm sure Rashad Vaughn would sign up for that right now if you offered him J.R. Smith's career.
Do you think there's a better chance Rashad is on an NBA roster next year or a D-League roster? And we both know he could be on both throughout the course of the season, but which one? Where do you think he spends more time next year, D-League or the NBA?
I would say... I don't know. It's really, he hasn't even gone through any of the pre-draft stuff. I would say D-League, just because I'm not sure that he can win a, like, I don't know if he can, he's capable of winning a job on an NBA team. Like, right, like a team that drafts him, if they're going to keep him, if you're going to keep a young guy, like a guy who's that young on your team, you don't want him sitting on the bench for, you know, 6 months. You want him, if he could, you know, come into, you know, camp and win a job, where, you know, he's going to be playing consistently, I could see him staying up in the NBA. But I don't think he could come in and win a job right now. I think teams would probably do better to stash him and let him develop and get more playing time against some, you know, D-League level opponents.
Yeah, that was sort of my thought process, too, was that anybody that takes him isn't taking him to contribute immediately, or anybody that takes him is going to say, okay, we're going to hold on to this guy for 3 or 4 years and see what happens to him. Because he could be really good. And so, I don't know, it depends on the team, depends on the situation, because, you know, Philly could draft him, and they could say, okay, you're going to be on our second unit. I mean, because he can be Alexei Shved. Like, he's not that bad. But if you know, a team that's actually going to be a playoff team takes him, then I could see them saying, okay, we're going to probably use you in the D-League. We might bring you, and you can play for, you know, 5-6 games in a row for a few minutes, and we'll see what happens. But I kind of do think he'll be in the D-League more next year, and he is a project. Like, calling him a project seems like a negative word, but that's sort of kind of what it is. Because it's not like he's terrible and they have to develop everything with him. Like, he's got some stuff down that he can do and will translate in the NBA, but he's not, you know, fully at 100% what Rashad Vaughn will be as a basketball
player. Yeah, he's not really what you would normally think of as a project. When you say use the word project, you think of a guy with, you know, a little bit, you know, very little experience, who's, you know, more of an athlete than a ball player at that point in their career. But I think Vaughn is kind of the opposite. He's, you know, he's more of a, like, a skill guy. He's not like a super athlete. He's never going to be like a high flyer. So you'd want him to, you know, get the ins and outs of the game. You want him to develop those, you know, sort of that basketball IQ to go along with, you know, the skills that he already, his skill level, I would say, is pretty high for a backcourt player, you know, entering the draft, you know, as a freshman. But, you know, just that, getting the little things down and sort of learning his way in the NBA may take a while. Let me ask you this. Rashad Vaughn officially gone. He was here for a year. Is that the entire Rashad Vaughn experience? Was that a win for UNLV, or is that a loss for UNLV? How did the whole thing work out?
I don't think it's a loss. I'm hesitant to say the win just because they weren't actually good during the season. But I don't know. I would lean more towards win than loss for sure. If he goes on to have a good NBA career, like, it's definitely a win just to have your name attached to him when he's in the NBA, because I think it was Tom Izzo said, for recruiting, he'd rather have a guy get drafted in the lottery than have a guy than win the national title. Like, that's what helps recruiting more, is being able to point to the NBA, because that's where these guys want to go. So if he goes on and has a pretty good, you know, if he has a J.R. Smith NBA career, that's definitely a win for UNLV. Even if you got 1 year out of him and that 1 year was an 18-win season, I'd still think it'd be a win. But just based on what he did this past season, I don't know. Can we call it a tie, a draw, 90-minute 0-0 draw?
I kind of feel the same way. I mean, even at this point, recruiting, there's a lot of momentum that goes into recruiting when you're trying to get guys at that level. So the fact, you know, Anthony Bennett helped, you know, he was a top 10 guy, and then he went on to be the number one pick. And then, you know, guys like Dwayne Morgan are committing, and he was a big time recruit. And then just when Vaughn commits, another top 10 guy, regardless of how that turns out, once you have a string of, you know, 3-4, you know, top level recruits all going to UNLV, it sort of makes it easier for other players around the country to start, you know, saying, hey, UNLV is maybe a place that I should be considering, if it's, you know, if all these other guys are going there and they're producing NBA players. So I think from that sense, you know, he sort of kept the UNLV buzz going, and landing Vaughn was, you know, good for that. But that's more of like an it doesn't really help in the fact that they had him for 1 year and it was sort of a lost season, and it's in terms of they didn't really contend. They never really made any noise in terms of making the tournament or anything like that. So they had him for a year, and he was pretty productive on the court. He wasn't amazing. He was very productive, though. And I don't know. I just kind of felt like it was sort of a lost season. They had him, and they didn't really take advantage of it.
With him gone, for sure, you know, it does mean Dave Rice will have to – there's going to be somebody on the roster next year that we don't know their name right now. Assuming he uses the scholarship, he could choose not to use it. But hot name now, Nigel Williams-Goss, is transferring from Washington. He went to Finley Prep. He's been at Washington for 2 years. He'll have to sit out a year if he redshirts, which would make sense. He'd have 2 seasons of eligibility left. He told the Seattle Times that the teams that have contacted him are, and this is the order he said them in, UNLV, Texas, Michigan State, Gonzaga, Georgetown, Arkansas, and Providence. Nigel Williams-Goss, worth using a scholarship on a guy that can't play again for this season?
Well, I think from that standpoint of, you know, constructing the roster long-term, I think it kind of would make sense. You have Jerome Seegers, you know, ready to sort of step in and play that position for 1 year. He's got 1 year of eligibility left. He'll be playing this season. I think he's sort of your I don't want to say a stopgap, because, you know, that sort of implies that he's not a great player. But I think you have Seager set to play that position this year.
I'm okay with calling him a stopgap.
Okay, well,
to go off track of Nigel Williams-Goss, I'm okay with, like, Jerome Seegers didn't do a ton of stuff at Rutgers. Like, he started about half the games his last year at Rutgers, and, you know, they weren't good.
Okay.
So I'm okay with calling him a stopgap. Okay. He might be good, but I'm okay with
that. Okay, so let's call him a stopgap for this season. He can play that position, and then, you know, while Williams-Goss hypothetically redshirts, and then when Seegers is gone in 2016-17, you have Williams-Goss ready to step in, a guy who's got 2 years of experience, you know, starting for a power conference team, and then another year redshirting in your system. And then he's ready to step in, and he's got 2 years. So it's not even like he would be a short-term player like Doolin or Seegers, because he's got 2 years of eligibility left. So from a roster construction standpoint, I think it does make sense to kick the tires and see if he's interested in UNLV.
He was Washington's leading scorer. He was top 10 in the Pac-12 in scoring last season. A lot of people are high on him. Obviously, if Michigan State and Gonzaga and Georgetown have all reached out to him, obviously a lot of people think he's good. I'm not very sold on Nigel Williams-Goss. Now, I think he'd be worth that scholarship to have him sit out this year. I do. I don't think it'd be a terrible decision if Dave Rice, you know, brought him on. But I don't think it would be the best decision ever, and I wouldn't have a problem if Dave Rice said no to him. He's extremely inefficient.
I know where you're going with this.
Do you? Okay. Well, I've got a lot of stuff here, so
I think you're going towards bad 3-point shooting last year and a very high amount of 2-point jumpers and long, you know, mid-range shots.
Yes, if you look, his shot chart is what Dwayne Morgan's shot chart would have looked like if Dwayne Morgan had been like UNLV's best player. Like, he shot 26% from three last year. That's bad. He did shoot 35% as a freshman, which is a good number.
On basically the same attempts too as a freshman. Like it's
It's not. And he shot like his percentage of field goal attempts. The amount of 2-point jumpers was about the same as Dwayne Morgan. They both 50% of their shots were 2-point jumpers. If you look at his effective field goal percentage, he was 63rd in the Pac-12. And if you compare him on effective field goal percentage to UNLV this past year, he was better than Dwayne Morgan. He was the same as Jalon Kendrick, and he was worse than everybody else on UNLV in effective field goal percentage. So I ask you this. He was their best player, took their most shots at Washington, and some people think, you know, oh, he'd come in and be like a second option or first option for whoever he goes to. Would you want a guy shooting as well as Jalon Kendrick to take the majority of your shots on a basketball
team? No. But...
And that's what he did last year.
What I'm going to say is, though, it's... Historically, in basketball, it's tough to be an efficient scorer when you're trying to be the top scoring option from the point guard position. Would you agree with that? It's like when you're asking your point guard to carry your offense and create shots and do all your scoring, it's tough to be efficient just because of, you know, the way the court is laid out. I mean, you've got to go through a lot of guys to get to the basket. There's not a lot of easy baskets to be had when you're sort of driving through the teeth of the defense. I do think that it would be I do think he would help the team. I think those concerns are obviously valid. He shoots a lot of long jumpers. His 3-point shooting took a big dive last year, down to 25%. But you know, the plus side, he's experienced. He can pass the ball. He is a point guard. Free throw shooting, 76% last year. That's usually a pretty good indicator of jump shooting in general. And looking at just into, like I said, in terms of the roster construction, you can sort of slot him in 2 years down the road, and you wouldn't have to rely on, you know, a freshman that you're bringing in that year to take over the point guard, or you wouldn't have to rely on, you know, moving Patrick McCaw there full time, or, you know, getting it from somewhere else. He's a sort you can rely on him. You know that he'll show up, he'll play, he can run the offense. He can score a little. He's a good rebounder. He can pass the ball. Like, he sort of does a little bit. I think that he would help the team even 2 years from now.
Yeah, I absolutely think he would help the team. I think he'd be a fine player. I just, like, people are really high on him. And it was like, he's the number one transfer this year on the market, or he's a top five transfer, whatever. I just don't, like, he's not efficient. And any team, like, there's a reason Washington wasn't good and he was their best player. It's because he's not efficient. And maybe if he's with better teammates, his efficiency goes up. Makes sense. But he himself can't win games in the Pac-12. Does he come to a Mountain West team like UNLV and now you get to play San Jose State and Air Force and Utah State and Reno, and your efficiency goes up and you're a better player because half your conference games are against really bad teams? Absolutely. But I'm just not convinced that he would be this superstar. And if you look at, you know, I went and looked at his pick and roll numbers. They weren't really good his freshman or sophomore year. He wasn't good in transition. He wasn't a good spot up shooter. Like, pretty much everything, he was kind of below average in terms of efficiency. The one thing, though, that he was really good at, he was second in the Pac-12 in assist percentage. And I haven't watched enough of him to see, like, you know, how he reads the court well, but I'm just assuming he reads it pretty well in terms of finding teammates for open shots. And to me, it's basically if he comes to a team and we'll say it's UNLV, if they're not asking him to be the first option, if they're asking him to be the third option and they're asking him to distribute more than Washington was, that's where I would see him being like a really good piece that really helps you. But if he comes to UNLV and it's like, hey, we need you to take 15 shots a game, that's where I don't look at it and say, no, I don't really want that. You're not going to go very far if you're having him take 15 shots a game.
No, I definitely agree with you. He's a guy that you want to slot in to a pure point guard role. You don't want it to be a scoring guard or a guy who's going to have to create shots for himself. But that's sort of been the book on him, is that he's sort of a natural point guard. He comes with that, the leadership and the ability to sort of read the floor and put guys in the right spots. He can get guys good shots all the way back to, and this is one of the reasons, probably the biggest reason why he's so coveted by UNLV fans, is that I'm sure you know he committed to UNLV originally. While he was at Findlay Prep, when they made the coaching change from Lon Kruger to Dave Rice, he reopened his, he decommitted, he reopened his recruitment, and eventually went to Washington. So he's sort of the one that got away. He was a local guy. He wasn't not local, but he was playing at Findlay Prep, so he's sort of a local guy. He committed early, so people had time to get attached to him, and then he sort of got away. So people sort of see that him, being available again after putting up decent raw numbers for 2 years in the Pac-12, and they say, hey, we need this guy. Let's get him. Let's bring him in for sure. So I can understand why the fan base is latching onto him now.
He told the Seattle Times in an interview, quote, "I'm not going to go anywhere that my role will be diminished or anything like that," end quote. That would be, to me, that'd be just a little bit worrisome because, I don't think you're going to be an NCAA tournament team if he's your leading scorer.
It depends on what he means by diminished. I've never spoken to him. I've never interviewed him. I don't know much about him personally.
Stop trying to have integrity, Mike. Just take the quote and go with it.
If he means diminished, as in he still wants to take, a shot. He wants freedom to shoot whenever he wants, or he wants to be, the guy, leading the team in shots, and he wants to be the focal point. I'm not sure that's a good thing with his efficiency. But if he means, he's a guy who he played 36 minutes last year. He played 33 minutes as a freshman. If he means he doesn't, he wants to be a full-time player and, be the point guard and have the ball in his hands and, make all the decisions and still play that huge amount of minutes, then, I don't think any teams would want to diminish his role in that regard.
Yeah, and, I would be fine with that. I just don't want him taking a ton of shots.
You get him in and you coach him up. You just coach him up.
I'm sure a lot of people are confident that UNLV has that ability.
You see him take those long two-point jumpers, and you after a while, you just pull him aside and you say, hey, man, those shots are not working for us. Okay, let's be a little more efficient on offense.
Dwayne Morgan was the only guy that had an ugly shot chart for UNLV last year.
Yeah?
Like their team as a whole, like Pat McCall's was awesome, Cody Doolin's was awesome, Chris Wood took a few shots sort of on that left block from like 8 or 9 feet that you wish he'd get a little bit closer, but they're not terrible shots. Like UNLV took really efficient shots last year on offense, and with the exception of Dwayne Morgan, and so I don't know how much that's coached into him, but I feel like if the whole team is, that it's coached into some degree.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of, they are a team that pays attention to that. And you can see that, like you said, the pretty much everyone on the roster sort of understood the where to get their shots and which were the best shots. I don't know why it didn't happen for Morgan. It's not like they weren't aware of it. Like this was even before the season started. After the open scrimmages, Dwayne Morgan is taking these shots, and even before they played the first real game, Dave Rice was saying, hey, yeah, we took him aside. We talked to him. We're trying to teach him the difference between a good shot and a bad shot, and 30 games later, He's still shooting the same shot. So I don't know what happened with Dwayne Morgan. I don't know where they stand with him, but the rest of the team seemed okay. Like that had been a problem in the previous years, you know, with I don't want to name names, but, you know, Bryce DeJean-Jones, guys like that, you know, sort of taking bad shots, you know, long two-point jumpers, shooting off the dribble over defenders, just taking bad shots. Shot selection had been a big problem for UNLV the past couple of years. I thought that they really made big strides this past season in sort of correcting that.
We're talking about Rashad Vaughn, Nigel Williams-Goss, and we talked about this last show, but who the hell is going to play in the post next year? Like that's we're talking about guys in the backcourt when I still feel like, and I saw a tweet that UNLV was going to watch some 6'4" unsigned point guard or something like that for next year's class. Like, who the hell's playing in the front court for this team next year?
They must know that Zimmerman is coming. They must know, they must have some inclination that Steven Zimmerman is signed, sealed, and delivered.
If not, you would like to think they have a backup plan to Zimmerman.
Yeah, I'm being facetious, by the way. I
know you.
For anyone that's listening, I don't think that anyone knows where Zimmerman is going to go at this point. I don't know. But obviously he would solve a lot of those issues, because if he's coming in, he's coming in to play big minutes and be a big part of the offense. But in terms of backup plans, I'm not sure. Your point has been, you know, for the past couple of weeks, is like people are relying a lot on, they're projecting a lot onto Ben Carter next year for a guy who has, you know, played,
started like five career games.
Yeah, he's averaged, you know, single digit minutes in his college career, and people are sort of projecting a big role onto him. I'm one of those guys. I think he's going to play a lot. But yeah, and that's still, you know, it's all the talk is backcourt, but the front court is going to be thin. Even thinner than it was this year. Like, Wood is, assuming Wood goes, you know, Okonobo, I don't think anyone is expecting him to take a big step forward on offense. People are just sort of hoping he can get to 50% from the free throw line. Like, I don't think they're going to be throwing it down to him on the block, you know, 8 to 10 times a game next year and, like, asking him to score with his back to the basket. That's just not – that's not going to happen in 1 year. I'm not sure where it's going to come from. Your Carter is – He's got some ability down there to score when he's open. We see him finish in practice. We see him score around the basket. He's pretty good at getting open down there. He's usually available. He's got decent hands. He can catch and finish, but they're not going to have anyone like Wood to play down there, you know, unless Zimmerman comes and, you know, is the real deal.
Could we see teams hack Okonobo next year?
If they're playing games that, you know, are – where there's a lot on the line, I feel like when there's a lot at stake, you see coaches sort of resort to things that they wouldn't normally, you know, in a quote unquote fair play situation where you're just, you know, trying to play the game straight up. But hey, if there's like tournaments, if there's, you know, Mountain West Conference standings on the line coming down the stretch and some team, you know, thinks that's their best chance to win, like, why not? The guy should be 30 something percent.
How many free throws did he shoot? Like, how big of a sample size are we looking here? He shot 33.8%, but how many did he take over the course of the year? Because I feel like it was a decent enough size that you can say he's 38% or 33% free throw shooter. Let's see. He took 77. He was 26 of 77.
And it's not like he's, you know, rattling these shots out and it's a small sample size. We're off that, you know, if that one had, you know, dropped in instead of spinning out, like, maybe it would be different. No, he just got up there and he was not close on most of those.
Yeah, I don't like what, and you could definitely call that Hackanobo, or maybe there's something better than that, but I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised to see it. You don't really see that in college basketball too much, but I wouldn't be too shocked to see it. More important question: how, like, let's say, like, Zimmerman doesn't come, Wood goes, and it's like, oh crap, Dwayne Morgan's the third big man again. How likely do you think Dave Rice would be to, like, playing a four guard or four wing offense?
I know that he gave a lot of lip service to playing, you know, small ball before this season started. You know, that was sort of what he wanted to do in the preseason. There was a lot of talk about, hey, we want Jordan Cornish to get minutes at the four. Like, we want to see if he can play at the four. We want to see if Patrick McCaw can play at the four. Those guys didn't end up doing that very much. Kendrick did it a little bit, but for the most part, they played pretty traditional lineups. But just the fact that they were talking about it openly and, you know, sort of giving those guys minutes there in the preseason maybe means that they're open to it. If they have enough guys to, you know, if they just have a glut of perimeter players, you know, if you want to run a lineup of, you know, Seegers, McCaw, Cornish, like, do they have who am I missing that would be like this fourth guard that you would like have to get on the floor?
One of the freshmen. I'm assuming Poyser or Jones is good.
Okay. So I think Poyser, Jones is more of like a natural forward. So let's say you want to go like Seegers, Poyser, McCaw, Cornish, and then, you know, if you want to go really small, you play Morgan at center and you're just like racing up and down the court, or you put Okanobo at center and you get a little bit more defense. I'm not sure if they didn't do it this year, you know, even after Cornish and McCaw broke out and they sort of had the personnel to do it if they wanted to, you still didn't really see it that much. So I'm not sure that that's something that they'll commit to in any big way next year.
I'm just a big fan in college basketball, especially, of playing your best guys regardless of position. And to some degree, you need a guy that's tall that can either alter shots or rebound. And to some degree, you need a guy that can get the ball up the floor that would be your point guard. But to me, like, especially in college basketball, if your five best guys is a point guard, two shooting guards, and a small forward and a center, like, play those guys. Like, don't worry about playing somebody just because it fits the traditional starting five if that's not your five best guys. So, to me, like, if they don't get Zimmerman and all, and they don't get another big guy that's any good, that they sign late or whatever, like, I would probably be in definite big favor of them playing, you know, Seegers, McCaw, Cornish, and then Poyser, Jones alongside Okanobo or Ben Carter inside. Like, I would be a big fan of that.
Like, I could see it. I'm just not sure if that's in Dave Rice's nature. I'm not sure he's, let's see, I've been covering the team for 3 years. He strikes me as more of a traditional style coach. You know, for the first couple of years, he was talking about, you know, we want to play pressure defense, we want to press full court and trap and, like, play up and down. But, you know, once they started giving up, you know, once the press breaks down and you give up a layup or two, all of a sudden it's like, you know, the press is off and they sort of scrapped it for the rest of the year. Same thing with small ball this year. You know, they tried it a little bit. Neither of those two guys, they would dip their toe in here and there, but they didn't really commit to it in any long stretches or really give it a chance. I just think I don't think he wants to deal with the drawbacks of, you know, these outside the box style strategies. Like, I think he's more comfortable playing a traditional style and just, you know, lining up his players and, you know, trying to out execute you or outplay you and say, hey, our players are better. I don't think he wants to buy into the gimmicks.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
I don't know. He's never said anything like that. It's just my sense from watching the team for 3 years. I feel like they kind of view that as gimmicks. The whole press thing, like a couple years ago, there's a lot of talk about we're going to press, we're going to trap, we want to really force the tempo and create turnovers and play that pace and, you know, force teams to play to fear us and stuff like that. And then, but, you know, they a couple games into the season, you know, they just scrapped it completely. It's like even if you watch the best team, like San Diego State, once in a while teams will break their press and score an easy basket, you know. But you sort of have to be willing to live with that, you know. You got to commit to it and say, hey, even if we have a breakdown here or there, we're still committed to this because in the long run, this style is going to work for us. I don't think this coaching staff really wants to deal with the drawbacks. You know, I don't think they want to give up easy baskets. Right? If they play small ball and they give up a couple offensive rebounds and easy putbacks, they say, oh, we're done with this. Like, we don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, the problem that you sort of run into in sports is, like, when you make a coaching decision in terms of style or lineup or whatever, typically what would be considered a good decision is, like, over the course of time, like, that would work out well for you. And so, like, you could say, we could, you know, sort of predict right now, UNLV would be a better offensive team next year if they played small ball, and they would score more points, score more efficiently, shoot the ball better, get more layups in transition, all this and that. Their defense might take a hit, but overall the net gain would be good. But the problem, and this is really like in all sports, but the problem in that situation is that what happens in game number 3 or 4? What happens when you're in the Maui Invitational and somebody just rocks you because of that? When, you know, Duke throws it inside and you've got nobody to guard a 7-footer because you're playing small, and then there's the reactionary change from what is essentially a small sample size. So to me, you know, there are coaching, and what makes like NBA playoff basketball so much fun is it's not over the long term. It's over the short term, and you've got to, okay, we're going to make this change and hope that it works out. It might only be for a quarter that we do that, but we're going to hope it works. But overall, throughout the course of a season, you do things that over the course of 100 possessions, over the course of 30 games, make more sense than something is, you know, you don't judge it off of 4 possessions and you say, oh crap, we can't do that anymore. You do it because this is going to work over time.
Yeah, it's hard for our coaches to take that, understandably so. It's hard for a coach to take that long view. I mean, you saw with Dave Rice, like his job was in jeopardy, like this off season. Like, so it's hard for him to say like, hey, you know, it's hard to sit on the bench and watch your team get beat because you're doing something unorthodox and some team is exploiting that. So it's like hard to sit there and watch that when it's not going well. So I can see why it's easy to go back to something that's more traditional, more comfortable, and you know, you're not sticking your neck out quite as much because like jobs are on the line here. So it's if you take a big chance by playing an unorthodox style and it doesn't work, or you get embarrassed in a big situation, then yeah, that looks bad. So I can understand sort of the reluctance to go all in with that, you know, gambling defensive style, or, you know, playing, you know, small lineups or things like that. So I get it, but I also see what you're saying where, you know, I would also like to see them, you know, go a little bit smaller if they don't have the manpower up front to be, you know, a traditional 2 big man team, it looks like they may not be.
Yeah, I mean, they very well could be, too. I mean, they could get Zimmerman, and Ben Carter could be good. And, like, they could have 3 really good big men, and, you know, none of this really matters unless they get in, you know, some foul trouble or injury problems or whatever. But, you know, there is a decent shot that it's Okonobo as the only good big man on the team next year. So, I don't know. I would like to see it mixed up more, if that's what it comes to. But if Zimmerman comes and Okonobo and Carter are both, you know, competent scoring big men, then none of it really matters. Okay, NCAA tournament. First, we'll kind of just start with overall. The 2 teams in the title game were 2 of the most efficient offenses in the country, save for, like, Gonzaga. I think they were the most efficient at the end of the regular season. But 2 teams in the title game, extremely efficient offenses, defense not quite as important. Does that mean anything?
Of course, with the caveat that it's, you know, it's a single elimination tournament, anything can happen. It's tough to draw big sweeping conclusions from that. But with this, you know, with the landscape of college basketball sort of shifting towards defense and all these teams, you know, trying to, you know, slow the game down and be very deliberate and, you know, sort of suppress the pace and, you know, focus on the defense, does that mean that, you know, teams that, does that put a higher value now on having a good offense because there's so few teams that have, you know, a really, really good offense?
I don't know. I think it does, but I'm not sure. And I mean, hell, if you look at Kentucky, you know, they lost to Wisconsin, who was a top 5 KenPom offense. They nearly lost to Notre Dame, who was a top 10 KenPom offense. Let's see, their other 2, they won in overtime against Ole Miss, and Ole Miss finished, 23rd in KenPom offense. And they won in double overtime against Texas A&M. They finished 80th. So if you just take Kentucky, their 5 hardest games, 4 of them were against teams in the top 25 in KenPom offense. And Kentucky was the number 1 KenPom defense. So, yeah, I think it does. I think it does mean sort of offense is more important. And that if you ask me, do you want to have a top 5 KenPom offense or top 5 I would take the offense. I wouldn't take the defensive
side. It seems like across college basketball, you know, the baseline for defense is that, you know, most defenses are, you're more likely to have an effective defense just based on the rules and how the game is being played. Like, it's a lot easier to put together a good defense, an effective defense, I'd say, than it is to have like an elite offense like a Duke or a Wisconsin or a Gonzaga.
Yeah, I don't know, and I would take the offense, and I know Ken Pomeroy, the actual person, not the website, tweeted something out, and I can't remember what it was, but basically he came to the conclusion that on any given possession, the offense has more control of the outcome than the defense.
Yeah, I mean, which makes sense. I mean, they're the guys shooting the ball like that. It makes sense, like say, like how they say in, you know, football, there's no defense for the perfect pass. Like basketball is, you know, it's a make or miss game. Like that's what something that as a Celtics fan, like that's something Doc Rivers, you know, says all the time. Like some nights it's just a make or miss game. You know, if the team's making shots, you know, they're making shots. What are you going to do? So if you have a team of guys that are capable of making shots and, you know, getting open and getting good shots, like it's you can beat good defenses.
Was the NCAA tournament unwatchable?
No, the NCAA tournament is always watchable. I'm not a big fan of the way the college basketball is played. Like, I don't think it looks that great. You flip on an NBA game. Now the college basketball is over. I'm sort of starting to shift attention now to the NBA. I'm watching a little bit more NBA now. And it's obviously it's night and day because the NBA players are much better. You know, it's a very, very, very small concentration of talent. But the game is just aesthetically so much better. You know, it's faster. Guys are moving. They're cutting. They're getting open. You know, they're making shots. It's just but the NCAA, the way the tournament itself is structured, it's never going to be boring. It's single elimination. You've got four different regions, you know, sort of converging. You get all these different matchups. It's always going to be exciting, you know, no matter, you know, who's playing in it.
I've got a question for you, and I think I know the answer to my own question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There's a lot of people that complain about college basketball being unwatchable, and it's like, oh, scoring's down, oh, pace is down. How come when people have the discussion about college basketball being ugly or being hard to watch, why are there no like advanced stats? Why is it just oh possession, or oh, you know, the points are down? Because like I feel like basketball as a community is pretty good with advanced stats, that a lot of people know a lot of different advanced stats stuff. But when it comes to this, like the average NBA points per possession is 103.8. The average college basketball this past season was 102 per 100 possessions. So it's not like per possession you're getting that much fewer points. I think I know what the answer is, but I'm just going to ask you anyway.
I'm going to say the pace of the games. 35 seconds is a really long time to have possession on offense. And it creates these pockets where nothing happens. In the NBA, you see a team, you know, the point guard will bring the ball up. You know, they hustle across the half-court line. They've got 8 seconds to get it across. So they'll hustle it across. They'll get right into their offensive action. You know, he's coming off a screen. He's, you know, probing the defense. He's going to kick it out. And then, you know, once he kicks it out, that guy doesn't, you know, hold it and then, dribble back to the center, you know, the top of the key, and then reset for another play, you know, and wait 6 or 7 seconds before getting into another offensive action, you know, before starting up again. The NBA, it's like it's just a chain reaction. They kick it out, that guy immediately does something, and then if they pass it, that guy immediately – they're constantly attacking and playing offense. In college basketball, there's a lot of resetting. They kick it back to the top of the key. The point guard will settle it down. He'll look over. The coach will call a play. He'll dribble at the top of the key, wait for everyone to get in position to start the next play, and then they'll wait a few seconds, and then they'll go. And so you have, within 35 seconds, if a team runs 2 or 3 plays, you'll have a 6-second pocket where nothing's happening. Then they'll run a play. If it doesn't work, they'll have another 7-second pocket where they're not doing anything. So it extended possessions just sort of lead to you have more time to waste, so you use it and you waste it. And that doesn't look good.
I mean, that's sort of what I figured, just because there was a lot of times Cody Doolin was dribbling near half court looking back at the bench, and people don't want to see that, but I don't know. People made it to be a huge deal. I still don't think it's like a huge deal. Like, sure, 5 seconds out of every 30, you're watching a guy just dribble there, but I don't, like, that doesn't bother me quite as much as I guess other people. But I don't know, like overall it's not like teams aren't scoring as efficiently, they're just not getting as many chances. To me, if they change college basketball shot clock to 30 or 24 even, I feel like scoring would ultimately go up because you'd have more possessions, but I feel like efficiency would go way down.
Why do you think?
Like what would Steve Fisher's reaction be to a 24-second shot clock in college basketball?
He'll embrace it because of the defensive advantage it would give.
I know that. No, that's what I'm thinking on. Like, who the hell would score on San Diego State? Like, this year, UNLV gets the ball across. Holy hell, we got 14 seconds to shoot? So, I feel like Steve Fisher, now, granted, their offense sucked this year, but in recent years, they've been a lot more efficient offensively. Like, I feel like you're not scoring on San Diego State
if
they go to a 24-second shot clock.
Maybe it forces teams to get more creative in terms of the way that they want to attack those defenses. Maybe they start pushing the ball a little bit more. You don't let them get set up quite so easily in their half-court defense. So, there's got to be some middle ground. Like, I'm not a college basketball hater. I mean, I know I just went on a rant about how long the shot clock is. I don't hate college basketball. Like, if you like watching basketball, you probably enjoy college basketball.
Not necessarily. Like, it's weird. There are people that love the NBA and just hate college basketball. And there are guys that love college basketball and hate the NBA, and I can't, like, I like both of them.
Yeah, I like both of them. If you can figure out a rooting interest, like in college basketball, why would you not enjoy watching? Why would you not enjoy watching the action? Like, I don't. Doesn't make sense to me.
God, who's the guy that bets, it's like the most successful NBA bettor, Bob Vulgaris, I think is his name. Like, if you follow him on Twitter, he, like, during the NCAA tournament would be like, I don't watch the NCAA tournament, but if I did, I would hate this about it. And, like, he would tweet things, and it's like, well, what, like, I don't get it, how you can, I don't understand hating a sport. Like, I don't love baseball. But I like baseball, and I'll sit down and watch it. And sure, it takes a long time, but if I don't like it, I'll get up or change the channel. Like, I don't keep watching it if I get bored by it. I don't understand people that watch college basketball and decide, I'm going to complain about rather than I'm going to change the channel.
Well, complaining is fun.
It is fun, but I don't sometimes I'm just like, this is entertainment. If you don't like it, like if I don't like a TV show, I change the channel.
I think maybe it's the fact that you can turn on the same season, you know, the same time of year, you can flip over to another channel and see an NBA game, and you can see how easy it would be, or not easy, but how you could see ways that it could be improved, or ways that it could be better. Maybe that contrast just makes it easier for people to complain. I don't know.
Is it the coach's fault?
I think that's just the way the game is. I don't think that it's anything to do with the coaches. I just think that's the way the game is. The rules are set up. You know, you have long possessions. Why not? If you gave coaches, you know, 90-second shot clocks, they would use all night. You know, they'd use all 90 seconds. Hey, when there were no shot clocks, teams only took, you know, 5 shots a game. Like, if you give a coach that much time, he's going to use all of that time. You know, that's why when a coach has 3 timeouts left in the final minute of a game, he doesn't really need to use them, but he's going to use them anyways. Like, if you give a coach that much time to work with, he's going to use all of it. So I don't blame the coaches for playing that sort of deliberate style where they're trying to draw everything out and soak up every second.
Is it the ref's fault or the rule/referee's fault?
It's the referees are not good. Like, I think that's pretty obvious. I don't think anyone thinks that college basketball referees are really great. But basketball is hard to officiate. They get, you know, the charge blocks are awful. The hand checking is off. Like, it's, some games are really physical. Some games, you know, you're all of a sudden your star is in foul trouble, you know, 5 minutes into the game because it's being called in a completely different way. That's the inconsistency of stuff. I don't know.
I mean, they missed that call in the title game. Like, it hit Justice Winslow's finger.
Did they ever definitively say whether they had that? Because I saw the head of officiating or something said that they didn't have that angle. And then, like, the next day, someone else came out and said, oh, wait, they did have that angle.
Yeah, I saw the same thing. So I don't know which one to believe. But I still think, I don't know. Like, I don't really know. I think I wanted Wisconsin to win that game. I didn't really care. Like, but I sort of wanted Wisconsin to win. But I just thought that was funny that they totally missed that. I don't know, but And I'll say this about hand checking. I hate the charge. Get rid of the charge. We've talked about that before. But I like the hand checking rule. But it's sort of like targeting in football. People complain about targeting in college football, and just leave those rules alone, both of them. And what's going to happen is guys will have to learn how to play without hand checking, and guys will have to learn how to play without trying to blow up a receiver's head when he's making a catch. And so in 5 years, when people figure that out, the games will be better. You won't have guys getting carted off the field going up for a catch in football, and in basketball you'll have guys playing defense with their feet, not their hands, and you'll have a lot less hand check calls because guys will know how to play defense without their
hands. That's what the NBA did a few years ago. They went heavy on calling hand checking and, you know, perimeter defense. They started calling those fouls, you know, by the rule book. And it took, you know, and obviously the players complained like crazy at first, and the coaches complained that we don't know what a foul is anymore, and this and that. We're not allowed to play defense. But the NBA, they backed off a little bit, but for the most part, they stuck with it. And now you see the results of that, where every point guard in the NBA is a superstar because you can't defend anyone on the perimeter. It's not. I'm not. Let me take that back. It's not that you can't defend anyone on the perimeter. It's that, you know, team defense is more important. It's tough to stay in front of, you know, those type of athletes. So, like, every NBA point guard can blow by you pretty much at any given moment. And it's opened up the offense. That's why you see sort of this quote-unquote pace and space, where it's all about, like, driving and kicking and then, you know, getting that closeout guy and then driving past him and kicking it out to the next guy. Because it's hard to stop anyone on the perimeter because they made that rule change and then they stuck with it. Whereas college, I think they started calling it, was it last year, at the beginning of last year, they really started cracking down on hand checking. But I don't know if they followed through on it this year. It didn't seem like it was as heavy this year.
Yeah, I just stick long term, like I was saying, long term, just stick to it. It'll be fine. All right, Mike, anything annoying you?
You know what? I do have something that came to mind that's annoying me. You know, previously, like when I've talked about stuff that makes me angry, it's been stuff that's like personal to me, like that really, you know, for some reason affects me. This what I'm angry about right now doesn't really affect me at all. It's just kind of a recent trend that is annoying to me. And that is, you know, you're an NFL fan. Are you familiar with Steve Smith Sr., the receiver for the Baltimore Ravens?
Yeah, I mean, what do you mean by familiar? I know who he is.
Yeah.
Do you
Are you aware of his son, Steve Smith Jr., that also plays in the NFL right now?
Yes.
I'm not, because there's no Steve Smith Jr. playing in the NFL. Why does he have a senior? Why does it say senior on his uniform? And why there's been just an explosion of players adding a junior to their official name, like on the roster and on their jerseys. When that's like,
is Odell Beckham a junior?
Yes.
Is he a real, like? Yeah. Does he have a dad that's Odell Beckham?
I'm sure he does, but Odell Beckham Senior never played in the NFL. Like, if I don't know who you're, if I don't know the senior version of you from playing in that professional league,
there's
no need for me to see the junior on your name. Like, Cal Ripken Jr. was junior because Cal Ripken Sr. was in the dugout managing that team, and they had to be differentiated. Like, Ken Griffey Jr. was junior because Ken Griffey Sr. was playing left field next to him, so they need to be differentiated.
Do they have to be on the same team,
no,
or can they
but
just...
You have to, okay. There has to be, like, some reason for you to be differentiated. Like, if I don't know your dad, there's going to be no confusion. There's no need to call you junior. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like,
yes,
everyone is adding
yes.
juniors to their name, and Steve Smith has added a senior to his name. He does not, as far as I know, he does not have a son sharing his name that also plays in the NFL.
Okay. If
and if, it right. doesn't, I know it doesn't affect me in any way. It's just this is as pure as complaining can be, because I'm purely for the joy of complaining about it. It irritates me.
If you grew up as a junior. Yeah, the same name as your dad, and that's just what you were called. Wouldn't you want it on your jersey?
You might want it on your jersey, but
but you're saying
you don't have a choice. Yeah, it's unless the senior version also play it, and if there's no reason to differentiate, like there's no need to jam it in there. It just seems, I don't know, it doesn't sit right with me. I guess in terms of you know, real life, I'm pretty liberal, I'm pretty progressive, but when it comes to sports, I think I'm more of a conservative and a traditionalist. Most instant replays, I don't like. Stuff like that. I'm not sure I'm on board with like stuff like that. It doesn't. I don't see why has to be done except to draw attention to your name.
What is Odell Beckham? His nickname is OBJ, right?
I've seen it both ways. I've seen OBJ and ODB.
OD. Okay. The OBJ one's funny to me. Because that's like, I don't know, his nickname, and it's Junior, and you're complaining about it. But, oh, I don't know, OBJ or OD, I like OBJ better than ODB.
I like ODB because there's no Junior in it.
Well, I'm aware you do, based on what you just told me. But OBJ just flows nicer, flows better than ODB. ODB is kind of hard to say. Like, if I'm just trying to say ODB.
It's also taken by Old Dirty Bastard.
That's a thing? That's an acronym?
Yeah. But that he's a rapper.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's why I don't know. Okay. All right. Oh yeah.
No longer with us, but he was a rapper. He's a pretty big deal. That was like his stage name was Old Dirty Bastard, and to shorten it for a nickname, we call him ODB.
Any references you make outside of sports, I'm probably not going to get, showing my lack of like culture or whatever the hell you want to call it. Just for future reference. So anytime you reference that, just assume I don't know.
Okay.
Just assume I've never heard of anybody that hasn't put on a sports uniform before. You know what? Nigel Williams-Goss, NWG, that does not flow. That's horrible. That's a horrible three-letter shortening.
Like, you can do... If you're... I don't know if people use that as his nickname. I don't know if he has, like, a real nickname.
I doubt it, because NWG is hard. Like, yeah. That's just no fun to say.
Yeah, I think if you've got a cool like name, if you've got a distinctive name like Nigel, I think people can just get on a first-name basis with you. You know, you may not really need a nickname.
I mean, I gave Good Luck Okonobo a nickname, and his is pretty distinctive.
Is it Okonoblock?
Yeah, but I guess you don't like my nicknames as it is.
No, that's fine with me. It's descriptive, and like you know what you're talking about when you say Okonoblock.
Like, oh, I am very excited because I came up with a nickname for a UNLV football player, and it's quite possibly the best one I've come up with yet.
Mm-hmm. Lay it on me.
I'm not telling.
Are you going to wait to break it out like during football season?
Yes, I'm waiting, and I've got a special plan for it. It's going to be glorious. Nigel, yeah, NWGs isn't good. You know who Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who plays for the Pistons now? KCP, that's a freaking awesome dish. Initial nickname.
That does roll off the tongue. See, in like name hyphenations, I don't have a problem with, because that's like, you know, those are your actual names. It's just like when Bryce DeJean Jones, when Bryce Jones added the DeJean hyphen Jones, like before his sophomore year, like, hey, that's fine. Like, that's like your actual name. Go ahead and add that onto it. But
is it though? Like, can you just add your name?
If your parents are like hyphenated, you know,
Yeah,
and that's like that's a generational thing. Like, there's a lot of hyphenated names because a lot of parents are not taking the man's like last name. People want to keep their last name, so like more hyphenated names. So if you choose to do that as a kid, and I think the way they do it is like, if you're a kid growing up, you're hyphenated, but then if at one point, what you know, if once you're old enough to make that decision, if you want to keep one name or the other, you can do that. So if you choose to stay hyphenated, I have no problem with that. But if you don't have kin, like, playing that sport or have played that sport prominently, there's just no need to add a junior or a senior.
What about a completely different sport?
Like, if your parent is, like, famous for some athletics, if there's a need, if I know them and there's a need to distinguish between the two of you, then it's okay. Like, there's a guy who plays for the Red Sox, is Jackie Bradley Jr. Like, I don't know Jackie Bradley Sr.
If Kanye West has a kid and names it Kanye West Jr. and he comes on to play, you know, in the NBA, are you okay with him being Kanye West Jr.?
No, I think you've got to be prominent in that sport.
Oh God! Now, see, I think you're taking it too far. Like, I know who Kanye West is.
Yeah, but the junior or the suffix has to be related to, like, your sport, because you're wearing your sports jersey. Like, outside of sports, you can be, you know, whatever. You know, Ted Williams can be Theodore Williams Jr.
So
the
basically
third.
What you're getting, like, for baseball, is that your uniform is just to identify.
Yeah, you just put your last name and your number on the jersey.
What do Markieff and Marcus Morris do? Do they just roll with both saying Morris?
I'm not sure.
I feel like they do, because, like, to put M-A-R-K and M-A-R-C would be stupid.
I'm not sure.
Because with them, that's how far you have to go to distinguish between their, like, because their first names are, like, almost the same, too. So you'd have to put, like, I guess you could just put MC.Morris and MK.Morris, but that'd be stupid. I think they just roll with Morris. I really do. But
doing a quick
search to see what they wear. Mm-hmm. They God, the Suns suck now, huh?
Yeah, apparently the Suns just do they just say Morris on the back. At Kansas, they had MC Morris, and
did they really?
Yeah.
Man, that's stupid.
I don't know.
Because there has never been somebody whose first name has been abbreviated with the first letter and the fourth letter. Like, that's never happened.
I don't know. Well, if Marcus Morris is, if his father is like Marcus Morris Sr., like, I'm fine with Mick Morris, like, because I don't know the father, so I don't need to, like, he's not a junior to me. Like, he's Marcus Morris. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I know exactly.
I know there's no reason for this to bother me, but I feel like it's such a recent trend, like, in the past few years. Would you agree? Like, you're seeing more of this now?
Yes. Yeah. Is there anybody that's the third that you know of that is doesn't have a second or a junior or a senior ahead of
them? I'm sure there is. I'd have to think about it. The one that really got to me is Steve Smith, because I don't like him in the first place. And then just adding the senior is just, like, so pretentious. Like, we get it. Like, you have a kid that you named after yourself. Like, that's... Like, congratulations, but that doesn't need to go on your sports jersey.
So that's all you see, is a pretentious man that named a kid after himself when you see Steve Smith.
The act of naming someone after yourself is not pretentious, but then putting the senior on your jersey to draw attention to yourself is kind of pretentious.
I mean, he could have, like, there is another Steve Smith in the NFL.
Yeah.
Not.
He plays for a different team. No. Like, if they were on the same team, like, you'd maybe distinguish some way, but...
But you may not know the difference, like, I don't know the difference between them. Like, yeah. Like maybe I drafted Steve Smith on my fantasy team, and I can't remember which one I drafted, but if it says Steve Smith Sr., I'll know.
The point is, the Steve Smith, the other Steve Smith in the NFL is not his son. So there's no need to have the senior or the junior. That's all I'm saying. And that's kind of what is annoying me right now.
Okay. Well, I already know what I'm going to complain about next time, and it's might be even more petty than that. It might be.
I don't know if it's possible to be more petty than that. You're taking something that's personal to someone and then complaining because it has some indirect annoyance to me. It's pretty
like
petty.
What would Steve Smith say to you about this?
I would never bring that up to Steve Smith's face. Are you kidding me?
He's going to listen to the podcast, and then we're going to fly you out to wherever he is right now and see what he says.
That guy's got a long list of people that he's punched out, like football, like professional football players, like guys who, like, slam into other guys for a living, and he just punches them out like it's nothing. So, no, that's not something I would bring up to his face.
I mean, I hear that helicopter outside your place right now. It must be coming for you already. One other thing. I saw on Twitter, Adam Hill said you were not the best dressed sports writer.
No.
Are you disappointed by
this? I didn't hear the radio spot, but I think that...
I didn't either. I just saw the tweet.
Well, the tweet that I saw said that he said someone else was the best dressed, but that I also got props. And I think I was the only, according to that tweet, I was the only other person who got props.
You were the only other one to get honorable mention?
Yeah, like, I'm happy with honorable mention. Like, if you know me, like, in real life, I'm not... You know, I'm not anything to look twice at. You know, I'm not dressed to the nines all the time, but, like, to be mentioned, I guess, is an honor. I'll take it.
Mike wears a suit to every basketball game. And so, like, Taylor Byrne does, Matt Eumanns does, and I don't even know what he's the AP writer is who Adam Hill said it was. Yeah. I don't even know who it is. I don't. I think it's stupid to wear suits to basketball games, but that's just...
You don't want to look like a professional?
Well, no, I just think it's foolish to wear a suit when you're just going to write.
Well, Mike Romala Sr. wears a suit to every game, so I feel like Mike Romala Jr., if I'm going to follow in that tradition.
Like, I don't know. I just think it's fool. Like, I think suits and ties are dumb as it is.
Oh, like as soon as the game is over and we get into the press room and like we're writing, or as soon as I go home and like start writing, I take it off. Like, I'm not writing in it. Like, I'm
aware. I just think like the idea of like collars on shirts and ties and suit jackets being considered nice, I think that's just foolish as it is.
Yeah, like you're,
because like what's the point of a tie?
It sort of accents the rest of the suit. It doesn't serve any.
Yeah, I'm sure now.
At some point in the history of fashion, it served like a functional purpose.
It was a bib.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's the origins of the tie was like a bib type.
So it served at some point. It served a function. Now it's more of a symbol. It's a nice. Yes. It's more of like a symbol thing that's worn simply for
which is stupid.
And I'm sure like 500 years from now, people will look back at it and they'll look at pictures from this era and it'll look as funny as clothes from the medieval era to look to us. But I don't know. What am I going to show up in, t-shirts and cargo shorts or something?
I mean, I wear t-shirts and jeans to most of the games. Sometimes I put on a like 50-50 college shirt or t-shirt, but I don't like wearing college shirts. They're stupid. They don't serve a purpose. Like people are just it's a societal function. People are just grown to think they look nice. They don't. They don't look any. Your shirt having a collar doesn't make it look any nicer than a shirt not having a collar.
And it sort of looks like you put in a little more effort when you like,
because it's
work to put on a suit. Like to put on a suit takes 10-15 minutes. You have to like get your shirt and your cufflinks and you have to tie your tie.
Which is inefficient and stupid.
It is, but it shows that like, hey, you're taking this seriously. Like if you show up to a job interview in a t-shirt and jeans,
I'm aware.
Yeah, your time is more efficient, but they also want to see that you are taking it seriously and are willing to put in the time to like go through all that to meet the societal expectation of what you're supposed to wear.
Oh, I'm aware. And I've done it before. I just think it's stupid.
Okay.
Like if I'm ever in a position to where I have people and I can tell them what to wear, I'm not going to tell them to wear anything nice.
That's completely within your right to do that. I'm just saying you're never going to make the honorable mention best dressed Las Vegas sports
writer. Adam Hill's.
Yeah.
Adam Hill's honorable mention.
That's not how you make the honorable mention list.
Okay, Mike. I could complain about collars and ties. That could be a complaint thing. I kind of spoiled the tie one. But basically, your collar is sort of the collar that we're used to. Now, granted, like in England 500 years ago, they had the giant-ass collars for noble people. But like the collar that we know, its function was for farmers to keep their necks from getting sunburned.
Which is still useful out here in the desert. Like I don't want my neck to get all sunburned.
Do you wear it like that, Mike?
I don't wear collars except for to professional events.
Because you can go inside.
Yeah. I only dress up for like professional reasons. Like if I'm working from home or if I'm in the office or something, I'm just wearing like a t-shirt and jeans. Like the only time I ever dress up is if I'm going to practice or if I'm going to a game or something.
Don't dress up for practice.
If you're going to be dealing with people, like if you're going to be talking to like Coach Rice or one of the players or something, I don't want to be looking like, I just rolled in off the street, I want to. But I still want to project the image that like, hey, this is a job that I take seriously. Like, hey, I'm doing a job right now.
Listen, you're a Patriots fan. Bill Belichick doesn't dress like that.
No, he doesn't. That's a good point. Belichick is right about everything.
See, there you go. Like Bob Huggins, he's my college basketball dressing hero.
Tracksuit.
Yeah, like that. Like if I was a coach, I would never wear a suit. Like Will Muschamp, the head coach for Florida football, or used to be, got fired. He wore a freaking suit on the sideline. I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Well, coaches need some, that's like an active profession. Like, you've got to be moving around. And
yeah.
So I get that. Like, if you want to have, range of motion, then, yeah, go with something comfortable. I'm just sitting in a seat. I'm just sitting in the media seat. Like, that's
And it's still uncomfortable.
It is uncomfortable.
See, I'm just telling you. You don't need to worry about honorable mention. Just wear your T-shirt.
If only it were that easy, you know.
Wear your New England Patriots T-shirt.
We all can't be as comfortable in our own skin as you are. Like
it's not about being comfortable in your skin. It's just wearing comfortable clothes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Oh well, Mike. Oh well. All right. I'm sure people were fascinated by that last 5 minutes.
I mean, he's
Mike Grimala over at runrevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff at Mountain West Connection. This has been the Towel Boys. I'm sure this will be one of our top three view or listen to because it's the end of the season and that doesn't make sense. But
trending upwards.